with our guest today, Jennifer Lee Selig, who is the teacher who was left behind.
Somewhere deep in the jungle are living some little men and women. They are our past, and maybe they are our future.
Good afternoon again. This is Tyra St. John with Inside Out, and the series that we're doing, we're continuing, is the DNA of Carl Jung. And we have with us today a very distinguished teacher from Pacifica Graduate Institute. Jennifer Lee Selig is a depth psychologist and a teacher that the slogan, No Child Left Behind, left behind. Hello, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Nice to have you here.
Good. I've been looking forward to this conversation very much.
Thank you so much. And you drove all the way up from the Bay Area. Jennifer, what about being left behind?
Well, I call myself the teacher No Child Left Behind, left behind. And I think there are many of us, in fact, who leave the profession because of the current emphasis on standardization. I always wanted to be a teacher. I think I was born to be a teacher. That was my vocational calling when I was a child, when my friends wanted to play house. They wanted to play with Barbies and play house. I always wanted to play school. I wanted more than anything to have a chalkboard of my own when I was a child. My mother wouldn't allow me to have one because they were too messy. Uh-huh. So what I ended up doing was going into the bathtub, and I would take a washcloth and I would soap it up and I would stick it against the bathtub wall, and I would use my finger to actually use that as a chalkboard to write in the soap and teach the dolls that were lined up in the bathtub. And so I was in absolute heaven by the time I entered into being a teacher in my 20s. I went into high school teaching. I thought that I would stay in high school for the entirety of my career. I thought I'd probably die in the classroom.
Where was that?
And that was in Northern California. I ended up teaching at a small school, Dixon High School in Northern California. Mm-hmm. And I was there the entire 16 years of my career. Things started to shift for me, though, after maybe about 6 or 7 years when the movement towards standardization began. And I thought maybe I could read to you just a little bit of my essay. My recent book, Reimagining Education, Essays on Reviving the Soul of Learning. If that'd be okay, I'll read a little bit
I'd love to hear that, yes.
About what happened for me. I began my career in my 20s as an English teacher. I fantasized about inviting great works of literature into the classroom and delving into them in a way that would deepen and ripen and transfigure us all. Literature was not an object to learn, but a subject to learn from, the venue for touching what mattered. For me, it wasn't Romeo and Juliet that mattered. It was love that mattered, and Romeo and Juliet gave us the excuse to discuss love in the classroom. The teachers in my department taught Romeo and Juliet according to their passions and gifts, emphasizing different parts of the plot, different themes, using different strategies to make Shakespeare's language and story come alive. Mr. Clark was also the drama teacher, so he had students up in front of the room acting out the play, staging mock fights with construction paper swords, directing Juliet onto a desk for the balcony scene, handing Romeo a Diet Coke to use as poison in the death scene. Mrs. Reed was our teacher with the greatest sense of humor, so she painstakingly deconstructed all the obscure and bawdy puns until the students were falling out of their seats in hysterics. Miss Banker was a purist about the classics, and she would read aloud the most lyrical passages, her eyes filling, then spilling over with tears. Students in all of our classes got a different experience of Shakespeare, from an appreciation of his staging to a sense of humor, from the beauty of his language to the universality of his expression of youthful love, each experience intimately tied to the passion of the teacher. Some will disagree, but it seems right to me to teach in this way. There is no one Shakespeare, and there is no one response to Shakespeare. What mattered was not that students all received the same Shakespeare, but they had a passionate encounter with Shakespeare facilitated by a passionate teacher. However, standardization changed all that. First, we were told by the head of curriculum development for the district that we must have students write an essay as the final assessment. Gone were Mr. Clark's videotaped performances shown at back-to-school night. Gone were Mrs. Reed's one-pun upmanship competitions in which students wrote their own Shakespearean puns. Gone were Miss Banker's Globe Theater Days, for which students memorized and delivered a soliloquy in costume. All gone because they took too much time away from writing the essay. Gone, too, is my particular essay topic, comparing teenage love in the 16th century with today, because that wasn't deemed what mattered most for the students to take away from the play. Of course, I am being extreme here. No matter how standardized the final assessment on Romeo and Juliet, no one can stop a teacher from talking about the theme of love in the play. No one can stop a teacher from staging a scene, from deconstructing a pun, from waxing eloquent on the lyricism of the language. It wasn't that those things were squeezed out entirely. It's just that we had to fight for time to squeeze them in. It felt extreme, as the classroom increasingly became a battleground where we had to fight to teach what we felt was extremely important. I'm not arguing here against teaching the basics. Nouns matter. Love is a noun and it matters. Love is also a verb. When I change it to loving, it becomes a gerund. Gerunds might be on the test, but whether you love, what you love, why you love, whom you love, how loving you are, what really matters, will not be tested. This is good. Love should not be tested, but it should be taught. Not taught as in, let's tell students what to think about love, but taught as in, let's teach students to think about love and give them a place to explore what others think about love so they can refine what they think about love. Riffing off Einstein's quote, there is a difference between what should be taught and what should be tested. Not everything testable should be taught. Not everything taught can or should be tested. Ultimately, I quit teaching high school because I did not want to teach only what can be counted. I wanted to be unaccountable. This didn't mean I wanted to leave students behind, but rather it meant that I couldn't see students as mere accounts received. They were beautiful, unique, individual souls, and I did not want to see them standardized. I wanted them all to take something different away from my classes, something that mattered to them, in the same way that I wanted to bring something different to my classes, something that mattered to me.
Wow. Did that realization come with that particular incident more than anything
else? It came over the course of time. There were many incidents that led up to that. But I do remember a particular time the year before I left where we were sitting around trying to come up as an English department with a standardized test for Romeo and Juliet. And we had gone away from having them write just an essay to having a standardized test where they had to do multiple choice, true, false, short answers, et cetera. And when we were trying to come up with those sort of questions, I realized that there was no way to do that without really dumbing down the material. To ask a multiple choice question on Romeo and Juliet where there would be one right answer left us with questions as inane as Juliet is a Capulet, B Montague, C etc.
And right.
Who ultimately cares? Now of course it's important to know that Romeo and Juliet come from different families, but to be able to match their last names doesn't matter. And that was the inanity of the standardized testing that I could no longer be a part of.
Right. I know my children were in a school in the Bay Area at one point, and there were two things that happened. One is that my son got hurt, and the teacher said to me, well, he shouldn't have been running on the playground. It was all asphalt. It was not grass. It was asphalt. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that happened was my little girl came home crying one day because she didn't know the difference between a map, a chart, and a diagram. Mm-hmm. I think she was in second grade. Mm-hmm. It was so ridiculous, and mm-hmm. She's a literary genius now, but it was just so stupid. But why is that? What's that all about?
Oh, wow, you ask a very good question. What's that all about? You know, I was thinking about that on my drive up here, that as adults, we would never stand for anything such as this. We would never, I was imagining the TV metaphor. What if we had only one TV channel and we all had to watch exactly the same TV shows at exactly the same time and we were tested on those TV shows after they were over?
Right.
You know, we would not stand for this. We don't all read the same books. We don't all watch the same shows. We don't all consume the same pop culture. We don't all do the same jobs. We don't all know the same things. And that is part of the beauty of the tapestry of who we are. But we don't do that with our children. We expect them all to take the exact same classes, learn the same material, regurgitate the same material on a test where it can be counted. Why we do that to our children is really, it's beyond me.
Right. When I went back to school to get my BA, I went to Goddard College, which I loved. And it opened my mind to what learning was all about. I had a wonderful teacher who said to me when I told him that I didn't want to read history because of all the detail, all the dates and everything, that it sort of scared me. He said, well, why not read it in biographies? So
brilliant.
So I read biographies for a year and learned more than I had in my whole school career.
Absolutely.
And loved it and still remember it because they were the things that I wanted to know.
Right.
You know, who the people were, why they thought that way, and where they came from, their mothers and their fathers and all that.
Right. Yeah, and it's the beauty of having a teacher who knows you and who can guide you in that direction.
Right.
Right.
Would you describe standardization in terms of the testing, just so I'll know how you're using the term all the time?
Yeah, I'm using the term as in all students, any given state and in any given, you know, in the country as well, should be learning the exact same material on the exact same time frame, because this is also very important that you hit certain markers that, you know, if you're teaching a history class, that you are up to a certain place in history at a certain time, that you are able to feed back what it is that you've learned in a, you know, all states when you have the standardized testing, that happens at the exact same time across the state. So everybody has to feed back that material at the exact same time. And there are right or wrong answers. There are standardized answers as well. And I have to share with you another very telling moment for me in my, right before I left teaching, was I was the chair of the English department. And I decided that it would be very good for our department if we all sat down together and tried to take the standardized test that we would be giving our students. And so we got a copy of a sample test, and we took the test, and we did not all score perfect scores. There were many areas where we disagreed on the answer, and we had to look up to see what the answer was because we weren't sure about it ourselves. And so that was a particularly ironic moment for me. If we as English teachers did not know the correct answers.
Right.
And who was writing those questions? Who was deeming those questions important, and who was deciding what the answers were?
Right. Even the psychology questions on the examinations are just abominable because you don't know where the questioner is coming from.
Absolutely.
What they're looking for.
Absolutely.
It's scary.
Absolutely.
Very scary.
Sure.
And so, and there are these really wonderful, loving teachers throughout our system who are, I guess, strapped by the system.
Absolutely.
Because they have to comply with whatever the school has to do to report to the county or the state or whoever reports to whom.
And that was part of the reason why I left as well, is that I did feel that way. I was feeling more and more restricted, and I was also feeling like the gifts that I had to offer as a teacher were not wanted any longer by my school district, by the state itself, and that anybody could come in and teach what was going to be on the test. We started to move more back into teaching grammar again, and grammar is not one of my specialties, even though I'm a decent writer. So I felt like it was important for me perhaps to leave education so that they could bring in people who could teach to the test, because, you know, the trap of it all is that students don't do well on the tests. They may not be able to get into the college of their choice because their grades will suffer, et cetera. And so I felt like I was more and more doing them a disservice in teaching the things that I felt mattered to me and mattered to them, and allowing some latitude in that because of the ultimate end goal, how important the test actually is.
Right. Do you have your master's in education?
I have a teaching credential. I have a master's in multicultural literature. Yeah.
Right. There you were, sort of without a job if you left, right?
Yes, I decided I left for a while. I left after teaching for 16 years, and I had been in the classroom my entire life since I was 5 years old. I had been either a student or a teacher, and so I left. And I wandered around for a while. You know, I sold my house. I sold my car. I got a car that was good for driving, and I took off, and I drove around the country with my two dogs in the back seat. And I asked myself over and over again, you know, who am I if I'm not a teacher? Who will I be if I'm not in the classroom? And what I came to was the realization that I am a teacher. That, you know, again, that I was born a teacher, that was my particular vocational calling, and I could not teach. And so I wandered back into the classroom again, into graduate teaching. I taught for a while, a very gentle reentry. I taught, of all things, curriculum development to secondary school teachers. Potential, they were still students. They were getting their secondary credentials, and I taught them curriculum development. And I opened in teaching curriculum development. I opened by talking about not the curriculum itself, but about what makes for a memorable teaching encounter.
Mm-hmm.
And if I could just read to you another little piece from the essay about my experience there. I asked the students to share about their favorite teacher, the one who inspired them to enter the profession. After they introduced their teachers, I asked them to tell why that teacher was so influential. I listened carefully to the stories. Sometimes it's, she made me feel special. At other times, it's she saw me. He cared about me. He encouraged me during a time when it was really hard for me. When my dad died, she came to the funeral. Never is it she really helped prepare me for the standardized test. Never. He stayed so close to the state standards. It's never the standardization students appreciate, but the individuation. She made me feel special. He gave me a book he knew I would love. He recognized my ability to draw and encouraged me. Even those who recognize their teacher's infectious love for the subject matter often remember little of the subject matter itself. For instance, one young woman remembered a physics teacher who would dress up like a mad scientist on lab days, but when I asked her to describe the content of the labs, she couldn't remember any of them. Another remembered his teacher's love for poetry, but could only recall one of the poems she had loved. Some remembered disliking the subject matter themselves and marveling that someone else could love it so. What mattered in the educational encounter, I asked. What did these stories have in common? On the chalkboard, we note the similarities. It's the human connection, the passion, the eros, the joy of learning, the journey from having a question to finding an answer. It's seldom the answer itself. But education these days is obsessed with the answer, the outcome, the measurable learning result. Objectives, not subjectives like passion, like attention, like encouragement, like love. We have forgotten Einstein's other theory of relativity. Not everything that can be counted counts, and not everything that counts can be counted. In education today, it's all about what can be counted, measured, assessed, quantified. And so we did an exercise with quantification. I asked the students, you were in that class with that teacher for 180 days, for 180 hours. Tell me what you did in those hours. They can't account for them. He made me think, one student shares about a beloved history teacher. About what? I reply. What was the curriculum? What did you do in all those hours? She furrows her brow. I don't remember. I just remember he made me think so hard sometimes I'd leave class with a headache. We smile. We all recognize good teaching, though we have no idea what the goods were he was teaching. These are not students who are decades away from high school themselves. These are students in their early 20s being asked to recall what happened 5, 6, 7 years before. And so I ask, if you've already forgotten the vast majority of the curriculum you learned from your favorite teacher, what are the implications for your own teaching, for your own curriculum development? The room is silent. We sit steeped in the question, which is really a koan. I can hear their minds racing, their hearts beating, their stomachs growling. We all know one thing. We want to teach because we believe it matters. Soon the silence is broken when someone raises the inevitable question, but how can I teach what I believe matters if I have to cover all this material for the standardized state exams? Everyone looks at me. I look out the window. There is no easy answer to this insight. I turn them instead to look at a myth, to the moment in the search for the Holy Grail in which Percival learns to ask, whom does the Grail serve? Together we wonder over the question, whom does education serve? Student, society, state, whom does education serve? Whom do we as teachers serve? Perhaps I am not the best one to guide them through the rough and tumble of these thorny questions and cones. After all, I am the teacher No Child Left Behind. I am a high school dropout. I am full of regret, not only personal regret, but public regret, that this is the state of education these students who strive to become teachers inherit today. I share with them my questions, my struggles, my successes and failures, my strategies for resistance, my regrets, all of which are mine, but not mine alone. They are shared by many teachers, those who had the courage of their convictions and dropped out, and those who have the courage of their convictions and stay in. Mm-hmm. I am not the first who stayed and asked, should I leave? I am not the last to leave and ask, should I have stayed? I am not the only one who asks, should I go back in? And then, could I go back in?
Mm. You have a very strong literary way of writing.
Thank you.
You're a wonderful writer.
Thank you.
Do you write poetry?
Well, I've always loved writing, and I was thinking about this today also, that part of what standardization does is it requires that you parcel out time to all the different disciplines. And so I spent a tremendous amount of time taking math courses and
of course,
moved all the way up to advanced calculus. And today, you know, what I remembered about math is so minimal, and thank God for the calculator. And so I've forgotten much more than, you know, than I could tell you about that. But I was wondering what would have happened if someone would have recognized my ability to write as a child, and what would happen if time were devoted to that, if I didn't have to take all those math classes, if I could have taken less science, because that's certainly not something that I'm interested in or involved in now. What if I had had a teacher who could have particularized the curriculum for me so that I could have developed my voice as a writer more? And what kind of a writer would I be now? And that was a question that particularly is sticking with me. What kind of a writer would I be now had that happened?
Right. That's what you mean by particularization. I saw that term, and I've heard you say it, but I didn't know exactly what you meant.
Yeah, what I mean by that is the opposite of standardization, I would say, is particularization, where what we do as teachers is that we see our students as particular, as individual, as unique, and it is our job not to teach them all the same thing, not to mold them all in the same way, but to really find out what it is about them, what makes them unique, what their calling is, what gifts they have to offer the world, and to bring those gifts out, to foster those gifts, to nurture those gifts, to allow them to unfold in time.
That's a kind of Jungian principle.
It's very, very much a Jungian principle.
Isn't it? What is that? What is that principle?
Well, I would call it the principle of individuation, that we come into this world. Jung was very teleological in function, and so he believed that the psyche is moving towards an end goal in some way, and that end goal is to become our own unique individual. Mm-hmm. And so I contrast teaching for individuation, which would mean to help a student to become, you know, the best possible selves, the selves that they were meant to be, and express that self fully, versus what we do now, which is teaching for information. And it's a very different kind of teaching.
Right, and boring.
Yeah.
Boring and flat, and the kind of place and where you're looking at the winter you want to leave.
Yeah, absolutely. It's it's very soul-killing. Mm-hmm. When we look at soul and we look at the idea of ensouled education, we remember that soul and psyche are synonymous terms, and that psyche is connected with spirit and with breath and with inspiration and excitement. And I'm arguing for an education that's ensouled, that's passionate, that makes students feel more alive rather than less alive. And I tell you, in watching students take standardized tests day in, day out, you know, in the spring, that's when they're given, how absolutely soul-killing that is to watch students sit there and be subjected to that kind of testing.
Would you say that the Rudolf Steiner education is kind of close to the kinds of things you're talking about?
I think it's close to that, and I think there are other models for that as well. Certainly Waldorf education, certainly some charter schools are looking at ways that they can help to develop the children. I'm on a crusade at this point in my life. The program we have in California called GATE, you may be familiar with.
It's GATE?
GATE. It stands for Gifted and Talented Education.
Oh, GATE, okay.
And the idea behind GATE is that there are certain criterion that students need to meet to be considered gifted and talented. And then they go into special enrichment programs to help to develop those gifts and talents. And it's my belief that all students, all children come into the world gifted and talented, and that it is our job as educators, as parents, as community members, as aunts and uncles, it's our job to help find where those students are gifted and talented, not to create some sort of a standardized process by which we say, you, young man, are gifted and talented, and you, young woman, are not.
Right. Did you have a religious background of any kind?
I did. I grew up Methodist.
Uh-huh. I grew up as a Methodist also.
Uh-huh. I heard something really wonderful in the church that stayed with me always, and it was on Christmas morning, and the minister said, when God wants something done in the world, a child is born.
Mm.
And that stayed with me always. That then it becomes our job as educators to help that child do the work that they're meant to do in the world, to do the work that they're brought into the world to do. And this is very much a Jungian idea. It's very much an idea that comes out of archetypal psychology as well. James Hillman in The Soul's Code writes about this idea that we come in with a particular vocation or calling, and it's up for us to express that particular calling.
That's in this book.
James Hillman is also, he's one of the contributors in the book,
right,
as well.
So the book is actually an anthology, sort of, I guess you'd call it.
Yes.
But it's a group of essays by really, really interesting creative people. As you say, everyone is creative if we can just find it. These are people who have sort of found their niche in the creative world. So some of the people that are involved are James Hillman, whom you mentioned, mm-hmm. who is an amazing, almost controversial writer.
Absolutely.
Right? Because he disagreed with Carl Jung about certain things. Mm-hmm. He's going to be on this show if we can get him well after some surgery.
Yes.
Christine Downing on the vocation of teaching, mm-hmm. and Thomas Moore on the dance of learning. Thomas Moore, as you well know, does homeschooling with
yes.
his daughter.
And he writes about that. His essay is about his experience homeschooling his daughter.
Right.
And he, you know, it's really, he's wonderful. There's a passage in here where he talks about, let me just read this one paragraph. He had to homeschool his daughter because she became sick and couldn't attend regular education. And she was 15 years old when he began this. And he talks about the struggle that he has in homeschooling her. He says, one of the most helpful and challenging ideas I came up with was to follow my daughter's initiative rather than force her to squeeze into my ideas about the content and form of learning. I imagine our lessons as now as a dance in which I follow and she leads. Now, just that passage, you can hear how heretical that would be for teaching, for teachers to imagine themselves as following
right.
rather than leading. But the idea is that if we are to help bring out the best in our students, to bring out their calling, that's what we need to do, is to follow their lead.
That would be an interesting concept for marriage or for partnership also, wouldn't it? Because we all want to lead. And that's where our conflict usually comes in.
Absolutely. And in projecting what we want into the other person as
right.
well. Projection plays out here.
Right.
And so projection in the classroom as well is that this is what we think you should be as teachers. You know, we have some of the language in education when we go to create a syllabus, and this happens even at the college level. We are to create what's called a student-centered learning objective.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a joke of a term, in fact, because a student-centered learning objective says something like, begins by saying students will, and it follows with a colon,
right.
and it lists all of the things that students will do.
Uh-huh.
Now, I don't find this student-centered at all. Students have no choice in what they will or won't do. This is created by a teacher, and even the word will there, students
right.
will. It's not students might. It's not if we're lucky, students may, but it's students will, and it's very willful. And what Thomas Moore talks about in his essay really is this dance of learning where you have to let go of will and you have to follow each other. And he says he doesn't let go of it entirely, that there's times he needs to rein in his daughter as well, and there's times he needs to provide structure, but it's about learning when those times are.
And the irony is that she wants to go on through the summer. He wants a little time off. I think that's delightful. And she sounds so happy. She's asking him questions in learning that he didn't even know he would need to teach.
Well, and he says, what a decision. When a decision has to be made about the schooling, at first I'm tempted to blurt out a solution, but I catch myself and say, what do you think? What do you want to do? I find that this way the Eros remains in her sphere. Her passion grows and has its own tempo. She accomplishes more and does it happily.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, this is a really foreign idea. We would never ask, you know, our students, well, what do you think? What do you need to learn?
Right. I was in a tutoring training this morning for reading, for a literacy program, and that's the question that they want asked. I mean, they're suggesting mm-hmm. that we ask, you know, frequently, what do you think? What do you like? What do you like this character?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? What would you do if you were in his shoes or in her shoes? And finding out what they like and what they want, and to bring out their talents and understandings.
Absolutely.
It's pretty cool.
Absolutely. But you can't test that.
No.
You can't put that on a state test where you say, what did you think of this character? And then measure that, you know, result in any sort of quantifiable way and compare that across students.
I know you don't want to get into any of this administrative policy and all that kind of thing, but it is a real big thing for us all to try to figure out as to how to have a creative education that is not, that doesn't have to be, quote, accountable in the ABCs and the math, you know, all that. It's an issue because most education is funded by public monies.
Right.
So, and I was talking with a teacher the other day about your book, and she said it's going to be a long time before we can make that happen because of that question. You know, I guess it's a matter of educating ourselves about the needs of children. The needs of ourselves in learning, thinking about how we learn.
Right.
And what what encourages us, inspires us, and what we have fun doing,
right?
What we want, and thinking, well, maybe someone else would like the same things.
Yes.
Instead of thinking we're odd because we don't fit in the standardization box.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
So how did you come up with all this? It's such an amazing concept. It should have been written about years ago.
Well, I think it is written about. And I think it, you know, it really resonates with Dennis Slattery and myself. I've had many, many parents, many adults who were wounded by the educational system have resonated with the book as well. Wow, the idea that we're all different and come into the world with different gifts, this is nothing new. And education, is it swings. It goes through spectrum changes. And so I'm hopeful that we've reached the end of the No Child Left Behind era and that can be overturned. But I think that what happens is that most of us feel so helpless in the face of systems this large and systems this oppressive, where we don't have control. We don't have local control anymore, and it's passed down. And there's, you don't even know who it is that you should go to critique the system. You don't know who it is that wrote those standards that's been passed down to you and how you can get to them to change that. And I think we see that now in the country right now with the financial system collapse, where most of us feel completely helpless to know what to do to change anything. And so I think the educational system's gotten too large and too bureaucratic. And so, you know, many of us just throw up our hands and some of us, like me, just leave because we don't know what else to do.
So I think the things that you're saying actually helps people become better critical thinkers rather than thinking it all has to come from the leaders, that it can come from within, that there are thoughts and ideas that do travel and do connect and do cause change.
Absolutely.
And this is what our government, some of them, are trying to do, hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that'll catch on.
I draw a lot in my thinking about education from the myth of the search for the Holy Grail. And in the Grail myth, Percival is the one who's first allowed into the Grail house. And the king has been wounded. He's been wounded by a spear that's castrated him, actually. And as a result of his being wounded, the whole countryside is wounded as well. It's become a wasteland. And that resonates with me. I think our educational system has become a real wasteland. And we as teachers, we're wounded teachers, we're wounded leaders, feel very castrated by the system, very much unable to do anything but take it lying down. And Percival, in his training to be a knight, he's taught that knights don't ask questions. And so when he goes into the Grail house, and the Holy Grail, he's at dinner with the wounded king, and the Holy Grail is brought out in a procession before him, and he's fascinated by what this is, and he wants to ask a question about the Grail, but he goes back into his education, and his education tells him, knights don't ask questions. And so he thinks, well, later on after dinner, I won't ask the king, but later on after dinner, I'll ask someone a little more lowly who might be able to tell me the answer. And then after dinner, he just forgets to ask the question. And as a result, he wakes up the next morning and the Grail is gone. It's the Grail house and he has to go out and wander. And he wanders out into the wilderness and he meets a woman who tells him, you're a fool. And what Percival means, a wise fool, that's the translation. She says, you're a fool. You should have asked the question. The question that can heal the kingdom is the question of whom does the Grail serve, which was the question that he wanted to ask. So he knows what the question is. It takes him 5 years of wandering before he can get back into the place where the Grail is. And he sits with the king again, and the Grail comes back out, and he asks the question, whom does the Grail serve? Excuse me. And in that moment, the king is instantly healed, and the wasteland is returned to a place of prosperity, growth, etc. And so it's a good metaphor. It's about the need for us to ask questions and to ask questions to those in authority. So whom does education serve is a question that I think is very, very important. And I'm afraid now that the answer would be it serves the state. I don't believe that education serves students. And I don't believe, even though we say we're committed to No Child Left Behind, we leave children behind all the time. By its very policy, we leave children behind. You know, there are more children who are not graduating, who are not receiving their diplomas, who are feeling alienated from the system than ever before. And I think that's particularly dangerous that we have this nomenclature that says we will not leave you behind, and yet we still leave people behind.
Right, and I think that spreads throughout the culture. Certainly it's true in large corporations. I used to work as a temp secretary in a lot of companies. I went to Geige and, you know, other places where I worked in these, and even in Washington, D.C., in the halls of Congress. They're all marble. They're hard as rocks to walk mm-hmm. on. They're very, very tiring. They're far, far apart. They're big doors, big lobbies, big this, big that. And you still feel kind of lost
right.
instead of a part of the system.
Right.
And I remember sitting, I worked for Turner Entertainment in L.A., and I didn't know how to work the telephone system. And I got fired before noon because I didn't know how to work the telephone system. And everyone there was dressed so beautifully, and I felt just, you know, kind of like I didn't belong, that kind of thing. And I just think these concepts that you're talking about and writing about are very, very broad, that have to do with adults as well as children.
Yes.
And now we're becoming this kind of polarized caste system of the rich and the poor,
right.
which is so ridiculous, because then opportunities are lost for a whole generation, a whole group of people.
Yes.
And education is such a basic place to start, both for children and adults.
Yes.
I think.
Yes. Absolutely. I'm very fond of Martin Luther King Jr. And King talked about the importance of valuing what he called the PhDs and the no Ds. And right. he spoke about really ennobling people's professions, no matter what those professions were. And he has a wonderful quote about if you're a street sweeper, about how very important it is to be a street sweeper. And you should sweep streets, you know, in the same way that Michelangelo sculpted or Beethoven played music. You
right.
should bring your whole heart and soul to it and know that it's so important, because it's a way of serving. And any time that you're serving other people, mm-hmm. ennobled in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think about that a lot, that what if we were really working with our students to ennoble the things that they want to do, to not create this caste system where certain skills are valuable, certain jobs are valuable. I know when I'd shared with you that I always wanted to be a teacher, but there was a time in my late teens when I thought, well, that's not a very high profession, kind of a middling profession, like being a nurse, you know. I think I'm smart. I think I can be something better than a teacher. And so I thought, well, what's better than a teacher? Maybe a doctor or a lawyer. And so mm-hmm. I got a job in a hospital, and to, you know, kind of teach myself to work my way up, and then to enter into medical school. And that was not where I was supposed to be. It was so clear to me that it wasn't where I was supposed to be. That was my culture telling me what was important, what was an ennobled profession. And Carl Jung talks about this, and he says, when you're on the wrong path, sometimes life will come in and provide you with a kick in the right direction.
Right.
An accident will show up that's very much on purpose. And what happened for me was I had literally a skiing accident, and I was in bed for about 6 months nursing a very broken knee. And during those 6 months, I spent a great deal of time reading and writing, and I got back in touch with my love for literature and for writing, and I thought, what am I doing going into medicine? Mm-hmm. And that accident and that time to be reflective led me back into my love for reading, writing, and for working with youth.
Life does teach, doesn't it? Does
yes.
guide.
Absolutely.
If we allow it to.
You're speaking of ennobling, because teaching is not a very ennobled profession in this culture. I've had 16 years of telling people when they asked, what did I do for a living? And I would say, I taught high school. And people would say, oh, I'm so sorry.
Right.
That must be so hard.
It must be. That's the truth. That's the truth.
Well, it has its own challenges for sure. But I found that, you know, the most joy in my vocation, I found in teaching high school students, because that's where I was meant to be. And so I think we also need to ennoble the profession of teaching more as well. So we are not just deliverers of curriculum, deliverers of information. We're actually guides, guiding these really precious souls
right.
to their highest potential.
Well, it's part of the materialistic part of our culture, I think, that we put the great almighty dollar there instead of realizing that the most abundance can come to us through the development of talent.
Yes.
And the joy and the fulfillment that comes from that.
Yes.
Helping people to know that. And, you know, doctors and lawyers are standardized as well.
Yes,
and,
absolutely. I mean,
and the people who are the standardizing people in government are extremely standardized. Just a matter of awakening, I think. Mm-hmm. Awakening the dream within each of us. And that's where Carl Jung is so valuable, I think. Do you mm-hmm. not? I mean, just the education of the whole person and the soul. It's kind of gotten lost. in our culture, right. I think.
Jung talked about how it's the job of society to socialize you for the first 25 years of your life or so.
Right.
Your job is to fit into society. And so in a way, he's making an argument for standardization or socialization. And that at some point when you reach midlife, that's when you begin to individuate, to find your own pathway out of that socialization. And there's many of us who are wanting to challenge that idea and say, well, we shouldn't have to wait till the quarter life crisis, till the midlife crisis, before we really flourish into the people that we're meant to be. What would it look like if we treated students from the beginning as souls on a path of individuation,
right,
and we nurtured them into that? And of course, there's a certain amount of socialization that does need to happen. And there is a certain amount of information that needs to be passed on so that we're culturally literate. And I wouldn't argue against that. What I might argue for is that we figure out what that baseline is, what we think students need to know. And then once we hit that baseline, we let them go their own way, follow their own paths, and we mentor them in those pathways.
The irony to me is that the socialization of people and the creativity of them can be very, very parallel. In fact, they sort of merge and work together. That people are more creative when they're socialized in a way where they feel trusting in a
yes.
room, in a classroom, or in any kind of group. Where they feel safe,
right,
and are able to say what they really think. That's when the creativity begins.
Right, right. So. Well, you remind me of another idea of Jung's that was I taught high school. I taught psychology for a while, and I taught personality types. And Jung's idea came to Myers-Briggs, but the idea of the introvert and the extrovert and feeling types and thinking types and sensation types and intuitive types, et cetera. And I taught that to the students, and they all took a test, and they figured out what their type was. And this was a tremendously valuable exercise that we did, because what happened in doing that was that students were very validated for the individual that they were, and that they also learned that other people are not the same as they are. And so if you are an extrovert, it's very easy to judge an introvert and think something's wrong with them.
Right.
But instead, we would just look at that as part of the scale of normalization. You know, we just took a couple of days to talk about that theory and take that test, and it opened up for students this tremendous understanding of each other, a compassion for other students' ways of being. It opened up relationships with their families where they said, oh, you know, that's why my dad drives me crazy. You know, he's a sensation type and I'm an intuitive. And that's where I feel judged by my family, because they're all thinking types and I'm a feeler.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very important as well. Well, I could argue that part of that was socialization, you know, teaching them to how to be in social situations with other people without judging.
Had I been, go ahead.
No, as well, it was also an exercise in kind of particularization of seeing who are you,
right,
and what are those gifts, and then what do you do? How do you be in life knowing that? How do you go through life? How does that impact your choice of career, of relationship choices, et cetera?
What you're saying makes me want to write my dissertation all over, which was about normalization that only comes through abnormalization, and it was applied to domestic violence offenders, mm-hmm. men. Largely, people trying to normalize
yes.
their feelings. Some of them couldn't read. Some of them had been cheated badly in life in one way or another. And they were trying to normalize. And that's where all the emotional and the passion came from.
Mm-hmm.
It's really quite an interesting theory. Mm-hmm. But it never dawned on me to use the Jungian, you know, Enneagram way of thinking about the personality types.
Right.
Which I don't know. I mean, it's a wonderful way to think. And
there's all sorts of different systems. You said the Enneagram. I'm looking at at different archetypes.
Right.
Looking at astrological types. I mean, there's when I taught psychology, I had the luxury, because it was not a standardized course, it was not going to be tested. So I had the luxury of bringing all these sort of wild theories into the classroom. And we had so much fun with them. But every time we took a personality test or type or explored a different system, students felt validated. I would say they felt validated for who they are.
We're moving right along, and I wanted to find out, you had mentioned there were several theories, one of which was, I think it was Jung's theory of vocation.
Uh-huh.
What is that?
Well, I've just talked about it a little bit, just this idea that we come into the world with a particular callings. Those can be expressed in any number of ways, but I like to connect that with the theory of the archetypes, Jung's theory of the archetypes.
Okay.
And I'm very interested in looking at archetypal roles. So I mentioned that I feel like I was born a teacher. And if we put that with a capital T teacher, a teacher is an archetypal role, certainly appears in all cultures across all times. It's a universal idea. Now, I can take that calling to be a teacher, and I can take that into any number of venues. It certainly doesn't mean that I need to be in the classroom only, because there's many ways that teachers can express that particular archetypal calling. But I think it was important to acknowledge that. So I could not be a doctor because I was not born with the doctor archetype, or we might say the healing archetype in that sense. And so I think that the theory of archetypes, and that we come in with archetypal roles, that it is our job to express them through our vocations, through what we're called to do and what we're not called to do, and that that leads to us living an individuated life, a life of wholeness, mm-hmm. a life of where we can offer healing to other people, and a life that's holy, all those terms.
Holy, W-H-O-L-L.
Holy, H-O-L-Y.
And as well as H-O-L,
yeah,
H-O-L-Y.
Hold, absolutely, mm-hmm. In both senses of the term. So I know that for me, the classroom is sacred space. Mm-hmm. It is a sacred vessel in which I do my work, and I step into the classroom, and it's absolutely numinous for me in a way that other people would not feel at all. They would not want to go into that environment. It's one of the gifts that I think I've been given in is knowing very early on what my archetypal calling was and being able to express that. And that's something I'd like for all of our students, and I'd like to see us foster in the educational system.
One of the interesting things in your essay, and there's another one I would like to read just a little bit of, is the Russell's letter.
Yes.
That you put in the beginning.
Yes.
Would you like to read that?
Sure.
You can read it with the misspellings.
Oh, I have a keepsake box where I keep letters that students have written me over the years, and it's a full box, and it's wonderful, and I go back through it because I feel so blessed to have had students who really were responding to my passion in the classroom mm-hmm. by sharing parts of themselves. And so I open my essay with a letter by one of my students, Russell, and he says, "Dear Ms. Selig, thank you so much for all the help you have given me with my writing skills." And he spells writing W-R-I-T-T-I-N-G. "Even though I can't spell, there's nothing you can do for me there. I've enjoyed," and he spelled enjoyed, E-N-J-O-I-E-D. "I enjoyed my 3 years of having you as a teacher. You are very good at what you do. I also believed that you've helped people come to realize how different but the same we really are. Thank you again for everything. I hope your upcoming classes will give you more joy than pain." Thanks,
Russell.
Such
a sweet, dear letter. Is that a high school boy?
That was a high school boy. Mm-hmm. And one of the beauties of working in a small school was that I was able to have students over the course of 2, 3, sometimes even 4 years, so that I really came to know them in larger school situations where, you know, you're talking thousands of students in one school, in high school in particular, in junior high as well. Students will have 7 teachers during the course of the day. Each one of those students will be in a classroom for about 50 minutes with that particular teacher in a classroom of 30 or 35. And so if you look at how much time a teacher is able to devote to each individual child, it's very little. And over the course of a 4-year high school education, you've had at least 28 teachers who have been split between thousands of students mm-hmm. and aren't able to really come to know you. And so many of the letters that I received from students were ones I had worked with over the years and really had come to know.
Right. One of your contributors to the book was Rosemarie Anderson, mm-hmm. who wrote Teaching as Mothering the Soul. Mm-hmm. And this particularly struck me when she wrote, "To teach is to mother the soul in another. I've been teaching a lot of men in alternatives to violence for the last 16 years. And for a long time, I resisted the role of mother. Mm-hmm. I mean, I got to be the wife, the daughter, the mother, all of those. But I sort of resisted because we were going through that age where no one wanted to be enabling.
Yes.
And I found, finally, I've given into it, that I think it's the most important thing I can do sometimes. Mm-hmm. Not because I'm an enabling mother, but because I can be the safe mother, the
yes.
person who can give solace, comfort, or another perspective, that kind of thing.
Beautiful.
And so much of what you say is touching me because of the little bit I'm learning as I go through my own career.
Uh-huh.
So would you read the first paragraph?
Sure. She says, "To teach is to mother the soul in another. In acts of love formed of soft tissue and hard bones, teachers mother what is possible in others. Sometimes the soft tissue of teaching is tender, supple, and expansive. Sometimes the hard bones enact discipline, planning, and timeliness. Whether soft or hard, mothering the soul tenders what is like oneself, and especially what is unlike oneself in another. In order to teach well, a teacher must also learn to take care of herself. Such a teacher is a master.
It's a wonderful opening paragraph, isn't
it? It is. And, you know, what's so amazing about this collection of essays in the book is that there are many different images of what a teacher is. A teacher as mother is one of them. Teacher as guide is another one of them. Teaching as a dance is one of them. And so when Dennis and I set out to create this book, I had a real concern that if we asked teachers what ensouled education was, or what teaching for imagination was, that they might all say the exact same thing. And they didn't. They proved me wrong on that. Everyone came at it from their own particular angle. And again, this shows that even with teaching, teachers are not all the same. Chris Downing in her essay talks about Eros, about teaching for love and for passion, mm-hmm. teaching your love and passion of the subject matter, but also teaching through your love and passion for the students. Dennis Slattery, as a teacher, is a wonderful, wonderful, wise guide. I would call him a teacher as the wise guide. And when you're in a classroom with him, you feel in very, very good hands to go on a journey.
How long did it take you to put the book together?
Well, from start to finish, maybe about a year and a half to put it together.
Right. Mm-hmm. We have 1 minute.
Okay.
It's gone so fast.
It has.
I can't believe it. I don't think we even asked all the questions that we talked about. But the book is Reimagining Education, Essays on Reviving the Soul of Learning, edited by Dennis Patrick Slattery and our guest today, Jennifer Lee Sellett, who's a Northern California person who still teaches in Southern California.
I do.
And she's not a teacher left behind right now.
Not right now. And I never will be.
Right. And you are a real inspiration to all of us as human beings is how we can best teach others. You want to say another word or two about that?
Yeah, that's what I think is beautiful about Rosemarie's essay when she talks about teaching is mothering what's possible in another. It's not about us as teachers. It's not about the curriculum per se, but it's about what is possible in the students that we're teaching.
So in the triangle of people served by the educational system, meaning the state or the teachers or the curriculum, more than a triangle, I got a square there, and the student, Where do we put our emphasis?
I think the curriculum has become the god right now at the apex of the triangle, and I think we need to tilt that triangle till the student comes up to the top.
The student has to be on top.
Realize that yes, it's the relationship between the teacher and the student, and the curriculum is what we deliver to them, basically.
Right. Jennifer, it's been an honor for me to have you on the show.
Thank you very much.
And I want to thank you for driving up and seeing Lake County while
thank
you're
you.
Doing it. Thank you so much for being here.
Sure.
That was Jennifer Lee Sellett, the author of Reimagining Education, Essays on Reviving the Soul of Learning. This is Tyra St. John signing off for DNA of Carl Jung and Inside Out. Stay tuned for Our Stories, Our Lives.
And maybe they are our future. Get, 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 get